Hello. In this Brewin podcast, we're going to be talking to Graham Hook, who is head of UK government relations at Invesco Perpetual and knows everything about Brexit and everything about UK politics in general, including who is going to be the next leader of the Conservative Party. So here's a slight spoiler.
I think the worry is that Michael Gove is still too toxic amongst the general public.
And to find out the real answer, carry on listening to this Brewin podcast after the following messages.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everybody and welcome to another Brewin podcast dealing with the fast evolving world of UK politics and the tortuous path of the UK out of the European Union. With so much change going on at the moment, we're extremely lucky to have with us Graham Hook, who is the head of UK government relations for Invesco Perpetual. And before we start speaking to Graham, I should say I really enjoy a podcast covering US politics, the NPR Politics podcast. They always start with a timestamp and make the point that things may have changed by the time you get to listen to this podcast. So with that in mind, I think we should point out that it is currently early on Thursday morning, and things may have changed by the time you hear this. But let's, with that in mind, let's start, Graham. We had these votes last night. What is the impact of the votes that was passed so narrowly last night?
Well, in some ways it's significant, and in some ways it's not.
Right.
So, I mean, in terms of the constitutional importance of MPs forcing through a bill through the House of Commons in 24 hours against the wishes of the government, that's obviously of great constitutional significance. But I think ever since the withdrawal agreement was rejected for a third time in the House of Commons, the decision on whether to grant an extension, how long that extension should be, has effectively been put back in the hands of the European Union. And we know that the European Council is meeting next Wednesday on the 10th. So the fact that MPs are going to force the Prime Minister to come to the House to say what length of extension she's going to opt for, and for MPs then to have the potential to amend it, yes, that's important, but that doesn't in any way bind the hands of the European Union, and it will be for the European Council to decide the length of the extension and the terms on which it's granted.
So was it always inevitable that she's going to have to ask for an extension?
Not inevitable. Not a long extension certainly wasn't inevitable, but I think given the failure so far to pass the withdrawal agreement, and to get a meaningful vote through the House of Commons, then yes, certainly an extension was inevitable, but that could have been a request for a shorter extension in order to give time for the House of Commons and the House of Lords to ratify the withdrawal agreement bill.
Okay, so that's interesting because we as investors, or the investors in general, obviously, they clearly had that view. The market has traded as if they're assuming that an extension is coming, and yet there are these MPs continuing to not pass the withdrawal agreement, who presumably believe that by not doing so, instead of getting an extension, they're actually going to get a no deal Brexit. Is that what's going through their heads? And is there any basis for them to believe that that's going to happen?
Yeah, I think you're right. Though there are there is still a relatively small number of MPs, particularly on the Conservative side, hardline members of the ERG, who do believe that a no-deal outcome is still possible, and that remains their preference. And I think, to a certain extent, it's defying reality in a way that we know that the House of Commons has voted overwhelmingly to avoid a no-deal exit. The only way in which a no-deal exit could really occur now is if the European Union were to turn around and say, I'm sorry, we've had enough of this, we're not granting any further extensions. You must make up your minds between passing the withdrawal agreement now or a no-deal exit. But I think that's very, very unlikely, certainly as we approach the European parliamentary elections next month. There will be no desire to effectively throw Ireland under a bus by forcing a no-deal exit by the UK.
So that's the leverage, essentially, that it would just be too... It would be extremely painful for Ireland, and that's why we can assume the EU will almost always offer an extension rather than forcing us to take a no deal.
It would be extremely painful for Ireland, but I think it would be extremely painful for parts of the continent as well. And certainly in the run-up to the elections, I don't think any politician, but particularly in the coastal countries, would want pictures of chaos at the Channel ports to be the backdrop to those elections taking place. So for those reasons, I think a no-deal exit on the 12th is highly unlikely.
If we have an extension taking us beyond... Well, actually, let's come to that in a moment. So the European... If we have an extension beyond the date of the European elections, it's understood that means we have to take part in them. Is that really the case? Is there a way that they could conclude that we could be members without representation or something like that?
I think when it comes to the European Union, you can never say never, because... Yeah. The history of the European Union has been that legal fudges can be found at the 11th hour. But certainly all the indication from the EU so far is that the condition for a long extension would be for the UK to take part in those European parliamentary elections. Because to do anything else throws into jeopardy the decisions that the new European Parliament will take when it forms again in July. And one of the first of those decisions will be to take a decision on the European Council's recommendation for the next European Commission president. And then from that appointment of the president will flow the decisions on who the next commissioners for each portfolio are going to be. So there's no situation in which the European Union wants those decisions, those very important decisions, to be in any way in any legal doubt.
Right, I see. Okay, so there could be challenges later if there had been some fudge attempted to...
Exactly. Yeah. If the European Parliament was seen or deemed to be improperly constituted under the treaties, then yes, there would be, I'm sure there would be legal challenges, and that would throw the appointments into doubt.
Okay, well, we've sort of progressed a bit through the year. Let's wind it back then to today. We've got obviously ongoing negotiations then between the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition. What do you think are they going to be the sticking points in terms of reaching a satisfactory resolution of those talks?
So I think I divided that into two: one, technical areas, and secondly, political areas. On the technical areas, I think the degree to which the Prime Minister and the government could give way significant ground towards membership of a full customs union with the EU in the future. I think some of the Labour Party's demands, such as having a strong relationship with the single market, depends how in negotiations the Labour advisers define that strong relationship. When the Labour Party talks about that relationship being underpinned by shared institutions, I think there's a strong scepticism on the government side that would in any way be negotiable with the government, with the European Union, rather. And then on the political side, there's an almighty row going on in the Labour Party at the moment about whether any withdrawal agreement that were to be passed by the House of Commons should be subject to a confirmatory referendum. I think that would be extremely difficult for both the government and for Jeremy Corbyn in a way, because for both parties it would be an incredibly divisive matter.
Yeah.
You'd have MPs and grassroots members feeling very strongly, falling on both sides of the argument, and holding their parties together during that process would be extremely difficult. I think for Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party going into this, of course they didn't want to be seen to reject out of hand the Prime Minister's open offer to negotiate and to seek to find a way through. And in the back of Jeremy Corbyn's mind is always the thought that if he becomes Prime Minister, then he really wants the UK's withdrawal from the EU to be done and dusted. He doesn't want to take over from the Prime Minister right now and have to be faced with the task of seeking to deliver Brexit, because it's just as divisive for the Labour Party as it is for the Conservatives.
Yeah, and is that true of any successor to Theresa May as well, that they would also rather take over after the resolution of this part of the issue?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that it partly explains why Theresa May is still in place at the moment, and why in the vote of the confidence vote in her that was held a number of months ago, MPs ultimately backed her, because no one was really willing to take the reins at this stage, because they knew how difficult it would be. Any chance of a honeymoon period for a new leader would vanish incredibly quickly.
So you don't think it's because she's a marvellous statesperson then?
I have to say, I admire Theresa May's stoicism and her commitment to the job.
Well, you're not alone in that, I don't think. Yeah.
How she gets up in the morning and continues to seek to press her deal, I think is, it's admirable in many ways. But
this is a sort of major contentious point, whether you could have a general, when we will have a general election. And there, you keep hearing, things are deadlocked, there's no majority for everything, a general election might just have to happen. And yet it seems like it would solve nothing. So, is it possible that we can still kind of sleepwalk into a general election that nobody wants and isn't likely to solve anything?
Yes, it is. There's certainly no desire really on the Conservative benches to hold a general election. I think the current infighting and chaos provides the worst possible backdrop to go into a general election, and how on earth you would begin to write a manifesto commitment on what your policy, your future policy was going to be on the EU and Brexit. Goodness only knows.
And would it be any easier for Labour?
Well, I'm not sure it would be any easier for Labour. I mean, for the last however many months, I think they've done quite a good job of maintaining this sort of ambiguity over their policy that keeps both wings of the Labour Party on side. But inevitably, under the spotlight and greater scrutiny that comes during a general election, I think they'd find it very difficult to hold that together. I mean, it's interesting, if you look at, say, the number of signatures broken down by constituency for the recent petition calling for the UK to revoke Article 50.
Yeah.
The highest number, the constituencies with the highest number of signatories and the constituencies with the lowest number of signatories are broadly concentrated in Labour constituencies, which sort of goes to demonstrate the splits within the Labour Party as well as on the Conservative side.
And that's presumably sort of metropolitan London and then northern towns or something.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Obviously, those who want to remain are broadly concentrated in London and some of the university towns and metropolitan areas. Mm. And then in some of the more traditional Labour heartlands further north in the country, there is a stronger desire to leave.
Okay, So we've established that it isn't massively in the interests of either party, but you do still think there is potential that we end up having a general election, despite the fact that nobody wants it?
Yes, it's certainly possible. So under the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, in order to dissolve the House of Commons for an election, there has to be a supermajority of MPs voting for it. So two-thirds of MPs in the Commons have to vote for an election. The other means of getting there is if there is a motion of no confidence in the government and that is passed by a simple majority. We then get to a 14-day period during which an alternative government may seek to form and then seek to win a vote of confidence. But if that doesn't happen, then a general election is triggered. So if, for example, a small number of Conservative MPs were to withhold their support for the government in a no-confidence vote, then that could lead to the initial trigger. And then if an alternative can't be found or those MPs don't change their minds over the course of a two-week period, then we could get to a general election that way.
Yeah. I guess it's just what would prompt the leader of the opposition to call one if he doesn't want it.
It could be pressure from his own party.
Yeah.
I think when the last motion of no confidence was tabled by Jeremy Corbyn, he did so somewhat reluctantly, and it took a lot of prodding from his own side and a lot of political attacks from the SNP in particular and some of the other smaller opposition parties to really push him to get there.
Yeah.
So he may just be levered into that prospect.
Okay, well, let's do the difficult questions then. Do you think that the Prime Minister and Mr. Corbyn are going to reach an agreement?
I'm sceptical that they will. I think certainly for the Labour Party, the path of least resistance and the path to avoid the damaging splits within the Labour Party is to enter the negotiations, be seen to have negotiated in good faith, and walk away saying that the Prime Minister has been unwilling to shift her red line sufficiently, and we don't think there's a realistic way through. I think anything else for the Labour Party to be seen to be propping up the government's version of Brexit would be too damaging internally and in the country for the Labour Party among its own supporters.
Even if she gave them what they wanted?
It's very difficult to see the Prime Minister giving the Labour Party all of what they want for the reasons we covered earlier.
Okay.
So I don't think she's going to be able to go the full way, and she knows full well that there would be a major rebellion within the Conservative Party if she were to go that far.
It's a pretty major one already, isn't it?
Well, there is, yeah. So
it's not much she can... Avoiding rebellions is not going to be a very effective strategy, is it?
Well, no, indeed. I mean, and she's suffered a huge number of ministerial resignations already. We've had 7 resignations, I think it is, from the Department for Exiting the European Union already. But I think the remaining ministers in her cabinet, I think those who support Brexit would probably be very strongly tempted to resign at that point.
Okay, so no agreement in the Prime Minister and leaders of the opposition's talks. So then what are we doing? We're asking for an extension for more indicative votes. So I mean, how do we resolve this?
Thanks, Guy. So the second part of the Prime Minister's statement at the start of the week was that if she and the leader of the opposition can't agree on a single unified way forward, then they will seek to agree a number of options which should be put to MPs in the House of Commons to be voted upon, and that the government would abide, importantly, by the results of those votes. Now,
this is a sort of edited, censored, official version of the indicative
votes. Yes. That then raises the question, well, is Theresa May and with Jeremy Corbyn, is she going to be able to agree on what those different alternatives should be? But if we assume that they can, then there may well be a process of indicative votes at the start of next week. But I think as far as going to the European Union with a plan of action is concerned, it feels unlikely at this stage that there's going to be a plan to be able to present, certainly a plan that the European Union could have confidence in, is backed by a sustainable enough majority to point to a clear way forward.
And these votes, will they be amendable?
It's unclear at this stage,
right.
And it's also unclear what the voting mechanism would be, whether
right.
it's a straight runoff between different options, as we've already had
yeah.
in the two series of indicative votes already, or whether they might try and introduce an alternative mechanism such as transferable votes to try and get to that majority. But if it's the latter, then I think it still presents the problem of, well, could you, if you find a way forward, is there going to be a sustainable majority for that in order to be able to get a withdrawal agreement bill through the House of Commons without it being substantially amended to deliver ratification?
And does that, so is that going to end up being a customs union in the, as that seemed to be the most popular option from the last indicative votes?
Certainly, given that Ken Clark's amendment for a customs union only lost by a majority of just three votes, that certainly does seem to be the most popular option amongst MPs. And, of course, in the last indicative votes, the cabinet abstained. So if the Prime Minister were to be able to deliver sufficient of her cabinet colleagues to back a customs union, then that could just get it over the line.
Well, I'm sure she will be able to. She rules with an iron rod, doesn't she? But
cabinet authority is, utterly maintained.
Okay. Looking beyond Brexit, if that is possible, are the parties going to be able to go back to kind of business as usual? Or have the divisions that this issue has sown, are they going to be lasting? You know, are we going to see both of these parties fracture in the ways that they're sort of threatening to do so at the moment, almost regardless of the outcome?
I think it's going to be very, very difficult to go back to politics as usual. Certainly on the Conservative side, but the divisions are very, very deep, and we've already seen MP Nick Bowles choosing to sit outside the party, not to join the independent group or Change UK as they're now known, but to sit outside as an independent Conservative. And it, depending on the future direction of the Conservative Party, there may be more Conservative MPs on the moderate wing who are tempted to join him. Of course, we know on the Conservative side that there is going to be a new leader at some point. So there may be a process of catharsis of going through a leadership election, which might help to unify the Conservative Party. But equally, depending on who eventually emerges as leader, it could prove to be just as divisive an issue and just divided a party as
they
have
we have
tried
now. Having a unifying candidate as their leader.
Yes, I think Theresa May was indeed supposed to be that unifying candidate. But I suppose what we do know is that there will be a very broad field amongst candidates for the Conservative leadership.
And without encouraging political gambling, but who would your metaphorical money be on?
It's very hard to say at the moment, and I think it partly depends upon the circumstances in which the new leader is chosen. So just going back to our earlier conversation about if the government were to lose a motion of confidence, I think at that point there might be a move to try and install a new leader of the Conservative Party within that two-week period in order for that new leader, new Prime Minister, to seek to win a vote of confidence in order for the Conservatives to remain in government. And
through the traditional leadership process, which normally takes...
Well, it would have to be a very, very condensed process, and it wouldn't entail going to the country to give Conservative members a runoff between the final two candidates. So this would be a process that was essentially led by the 1922 committee, whittling down however many Conservative candidates to a final winner. Then, of course, if we do go for a if there's the luxury of time, there is a full-blown leadership contest, then again, MPs whittle down the number of Conservative candidates, but then it goes to the members of the grassroots Conservative members in the country to then decide who should be the winner. I think, I mean, what we can say is it's most likely to be a Brexit-supporting Conservative, given that's where the weight of the both the parliamentary party and certainly the grassroots membership lies. But exactly who it will be, I think, is very difficult to say at the moment. I mean,
you've got some sort of proper Brexit candidates, and then you've had these sort of ones who've had Damascene conversions, haven't you?
So we're told, yes, more the
Jeremy Hunt,
Sajid Javid, and others. And then there are people who might be seen as latecomers or early risers to the field, such as I think Matt Hancock certainly might be worth an outside flutter if anyone is of the gambling nature. So,
I think it's between Dominic Raab and Michael Gove. What do you think? Gove too toxic?
I think the worry is that Michael Gove is still too toxic amongst the general public. And there's a lingering suspicion of him from his days as education secretary. Dominic Raab is more of an unknown quantity, given that he was only DEXEU secretary for a very, very brief period. So I think, it's difficult to call at the moment. I think, Michael Gove's best prospect might be if there were a very condensed leadership election purely amongst his own colleagues.
Right. Okay. Well, look, I mean, this is a fascinating conversation. I think we could go on forever, but in the we better wrap it up, because otherwise the whole situation will have changed between us starting and finishing the podcast.
So, indeed.
Graham, thank you very much for joining us and explaining this complicated and fast-moving area.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks to all our listeners for enduring another Brexit-related edition of the Bruin podcast. And please do give us any feedback, including stop banging on about Brexit if that's what you feel. Rate us on iTunes or wherever you found the podcast would be really useful. And then please also join us again for another Bruin podcast next week.